I've got it as about time to start. Continuing our class on evangelism inside out and trying to identify the characteristics of an evangelistic congregation. We're going to have to really get after it tonight. It's the third Wednesday night. We have the boys come in to do their Devo about 10 minutes early, so we'll have to cut it short. So we'll see what we can do. First question of the night, we're going to see if you're smarter than my second grader. Lucas saw my title for my slide and said, "Who is my neighbor?" I know what story that's from in the Bible, and proceeded to tell me about it because he learned about it in Lenora's class. So what Bible story features the question, "Who is my neighbor?" The Good Samaritan. This is in Luke chapter 10. You pass. You can keep coming to church here, Jerry. Good job. Jerry's on that one week at a time plan. He just has to get renewed every week. That's right. Luke chapter 10 gives us two approaches to the question of who is my neighbor. And as one of them is Jesus's and one of them is somebody's else, you can guess one of them's good and one of them's bad. So the first approach to being a neighbor is in verse 29. This is after Jesus has told the lawyer the two great commandments. And the second one is you will love your neighbor as yourself. So the lawyer in verse 29 realizes that's going to sound like a lot of trouble to me. So I need to get out of that. And he asks a technical question. He's a student of the law, right? Who is my neighbor? And remember, this is a good technical question in that sense. If you did what he did for a living, this question made a lot of sense to you. Because a lot of Jewish identity and Jewish rule and code had to do with, you know, we are Jewish, they are Gentile, this is clean, those are unclean. And so they did have some serious questions, technical questions about, well, who counts as neighbor? Maybe I've got to help that person some, but maybe that person less over there. And they had a tendency to want to kind of restrict who was included in that little circle called neighbor. Jesus responds, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say that the Wednesday night crowd at a church probably has heard the Good Samaritan parable once, so I'm going to just summarize quickly. But there is a man who is in distress. Some people that are very religious pass by, but there's a Samaritan, icky, terrible Samaritan. He stops, and he takes care of the man. He goes actually above and beyond what we might say. He goes the extra mile and takes care of the man financially and physically and provides for him in that way. And at the end, Jesus asks the question, and the wording is important, verse 36, which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? So he's flipped the question inside out. The man was asking, who is my neighbor? Who do I have to help? Jesus flips it inside out and says, which of these people acted like a neighbor to that man? And the answer was obvious. They said, well, the person who helped, that's a neighborly thing to do. And Jesus says, go and do likewise. So his point seems to be, worry a little less about who counts as neighbor and worry a little more about being neighborly. So tonight we're going to talk about the idea of connecting with our neighbors. But while I'm going to ask the question, who are your neighbors? Do you know who they are? I'm not asking it from the point of view of, well, how many miles out do I have to know? And which ones do I have to like? That's not our question. The question is, to whom have you acted as a neighbor would act? To whom do you show yourself neighborly? That's the question of the evening. And the church that understands that question is going to be miles down the road in terms of being evangelistic, because we've got that second commandment squarely in front of us. We love our neighbor as ourself. Interesting, you guys didn't like my statistics last week, so I just brought more. Can't slow me down. Can you name the people who live on your street? You people in Beggs don't have streets, I know, but for those of you that live around other humans, what was the answer over here? Some of them, okay. Some of them. I know the one to the south of us. Huh? Oh, and we met the guy named Bear. There's a guy named Bear, and he lives out there in the woods. That makes perfect sense. We really have arrived in Beggs now. We've got a neighbor named Bear, and he lives in the woods and has a beard, and he's a neat guy. I think he's the one with the noose at the end of the driveway. Yeah, he's a neat guy. So anyway, we met Bear. So you know some of your neighbors. Some of them, if they put the noose at the end of the driveway, that seems to indicate they don't want to get real neighborly with you. But you get some ideas. You get to meet some of them. Some of you don't. Those of you that live in a neighborhood. Now, Bobby, you live on a street. I mean, probably not fair to say, give me everybody on that street. But ballpark, just how many could you rattle off? Don't have to rattle them off. How many could you rattle off names to? About seven. And that's Bobby, who can talk to a stump, right? I mean, he literally just talks to every person he sees, so he knows about seven of them. Pew Research study said 28% of Americans don't know any of their neighbors' names. Not all, any. That anonymity is one of those things people want. They want to be able to move in. They go into their house. It's their little castle. We park the car in the garage, so you never actually even see me outside of the house. I get into the car, through the garage, I leave, I come back, and never actually have to step outside except to mow. I mean, that's kind of the dream for a lot of folks. Or some of us moved out to Beggs where we don't have to see any people, right? I mean, there's some nobility in that, I suppose. But the point is that there are quite a lot of folks who don't know any of their neighbors and perfectly happy that way, don't want to interact. You can see where that would be a problem if our second great commandment is to love your neighbor as yourself, and evangelism is by necessity an interpersonal process. It happens between two people. By necessity. It's the only way I know how to do it. There's other types. I mean, I can get up with a really big loudspeaker and just yell to whoever happens to listen. But ultimately, I think we all know that doesn't work really well. So the street corner preacher that just kind of stands and hollers at us, he's not particularly effective. Effective evangelism is personal, but we don't know the people. It's especially hard for preachers because the people I know the best all go to church here already, right? And so that makes me an especially bad evangelist because you're the people I know. I didn't grow up in this area. So the people I know are people that I met here. So when you think about that, that's kind of part of the challenge. Another statistic he threw out, which I thought was interesting, it sounded random at first. I thought, did he just spend a whole page on bowling? And he did. Bowling leagues are in decline, but bowling has increased. And you say, well, that's kind of, why would you care? His point was, people still like the activity, they don't like the interaction. In American culture, we like to do things by ourselves or with our little group. The idea of meeting new people and every Thursday night getting shirts and going bowling with them just seems strange to some folk. Okay, so you can see where that poses a little bit of a problem to evangelism. That's supposed to be with people you interact with if we are increasingly distant on purpose from other people. Okay, so Archer outlines four steps for getting to know our community better so that we can make an attempt to be more neighborly. Step number one, ought to be the first on every list, right, is to pray. Let's look in Jeremiah. Not all of these have verses, but this one will. Jeremiah 29. I don't think there are any real tough words in there. I was looking. The verse above it has all kinds of names, but I skipped that one. Somebody want to read verses 4 through 7? Bobby, go ahead. Jeremiah 29, 4 through 7.
Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and do not decrease. But seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile. And pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare
So this is really helpful, especially in light of last week's lesson where we talked about the church as an embassy, you know, that we really belong somewhere else. That doesn't mean we in fact, if you read the whole chapter, there were some that were telling them, this is just a short vacation. We're going back home any day now. And God says, yeah, those are false prophets. It'll be 70 years, so go ahead and, you know, pick out a house. You're staying for a while. This isn't a renting trip. This is a buy land trip. You're going to be there a while. Have your kids get married. Find a house. Find a place to live. Plant a vineyard. See, you don't plant a vineyard if you think you're going home next week. He says, no, you're not going home next week. You're staying a while. So invest yourself in this area. Live there. And then in particular, verse 7, seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you. Pray to the Lord on its behalf. Pray for its welfare. So he says, seek what is good. I mean, you're citizens of, if you're in Babylon, you're citizens in some sense of Babylon now. I know you're still Jewish and I know you still plan to go home. But you should also try to be a good resident where you are. You want to be kind to those that are in office and in power around you. You want to be helpful to your community. You want to pray for Babylon. Now, think about that. How hard was that? Babylon had just conquered them. And so the only praying they had done was, God, wipe out the Babylonians. And now God says, hey, you live there now. You pray for what's in the best interest of Babylon. Sometimes the nation you live in as a Christian is on your side, and sometimes they're not. We pray for the nation. Prayers don't always sound the same, depending on what's going on, but you pray for the welfare of the nation, for what's in the best interest of the nation. So, comments here, put down roots. So I'm going to make a side note, it's kind of snide, on behalf of long-term preaching. There was a habit in churches for a while that they kind of moved preachers around every 3 to 5 years, and they thought, Dad stayed a lot of places 2 years. Longest Dad ever stayed anywhere was 5 years, and that was quite a stretch. Three was more typical, because by that point, preacher starts meddling, you know, he starts telling you to stop sinning and stuff, and he kind of wears out his good material. He's on the back burner material now, right? He's got about 3 years of good sermons, maybe. You think you've heard that one before. And you decide, see, the guy you hired had things the previous guy didn't have. And so you say, oh, well, we fixed that. We got a new guy. But then after 3 years, you start to notice this guy doesn't have all the things you want either. And so we need to find somebody that has those qualities that this guy doesn't have. And so they would go find the new guy. Folks, this prevents ministers from putting down roots in their community. It takes 5 or more years just to get started. I mean, in reality, it takes that long to get to know the people in your town, to know people's names, kids' names, cousins' names. Nobody asks you to do a wedding or a funeral in the first couple of years you're at a place. It happens once or twice. I did that Martinez wedding. It happens once in a while. That was the first year I was here, I think, thereabouts, maybe second. But by and large, nobody knows you well enough. And so for those first few years, someone passes away, they call in the preacher from two 10 years ago, right? Because that was the guy they knew. They don't know you yet. So the problem with short-term preaching and thinking of that as a good model, the preacher is just an exchangeable part. We'll just pull him out and plug him in somewhere else and plug the other guy in, and that'll work better, is that it prevents them from doing any kind of this work. It takes a while for anybody to know you. But then after time, that coach down at Beggs lets you come down and say a prayer to the football team. You know, well, you didn't get to do that the first year, but year 6 or 7, somebody asks. And they say, hey, we need a PA announcer for the football game. Oh, yeah, I'll do that. I want to do something in the community. And okay, have that guy do it. Stuff like that starts to happen, but it takes 5 or 6 years before anybody bothers because they don't know who you are. Okay? The church has to put down roots. The members, the leadership, and certainly the ministers as well, to be part of your community, to be involved in what's going on. So the church is its own community, but it's a community that exists within some other community, and we want to be part of that. We pray for the community specifically. I added the word specifically. He didn't have it in his notes. I'm adding it. And what I mean is that you're praying for things. You're not saying, well, Lord, take care of Glenpool. Amen. But you know enough about what's going on in your community that you can say, this is going on. So-and-so's house burnt down over here. And the school had a tornado come through and pulled part of the roof off. We're praying for the school. And they're looking for a new teacher. And you know the community well enough, you can actually pray for things specifically. It's a good practice for you. It's the kind of thing God asks of us, to pray for these things. Not because God doesn't know them, but you need to. And the praying helps. And with that, to know...
Oh, that's a typo.
Not now what is happening. Know what is happening. Or as 1 Chronicles 12:32 says, it's important for people who lead to understand the times. That's a quote from the Civil War of David and Saul. And there's some of the men who stayed with Saul because they felt like, well, he's in charge, we're supposed to follow him. But some of them, it says, understood the times and followed after David. I mean, they were aware of what was going on. They knew the story. They weren't just blindly loyal. They understood what was going on in their community, and they said, that's the one God's picked. We're going to follow him. Christians need to understand the time. What's going on in Glenpool, and how can we be involved in that? What opportunities are there? We're going to pray for the community. We're going to partner with the community. We're going to look for nonprofits and businesses who are looking to make a difference. We had a great opportunity last year. Didn't get as lucky this year, Stephen, but last year, Stephen works at a Walmart and knew the guy who was clearing out all the school supplies and says, hey, what if our church backed up a van to the back door? Would you load up all the school supplies and let them give them to the local school? And so we did. So we partnered with the Walmart. We wanted to get rid of something. We wanted to get it to people who needed it, and it just kind of worked out. Stuff got where it needed to go. But that only works because you know a guy who knows a guy, right? We'd call Walmart 100 times and never get anything, but if you know the guy who knows a guy, if you have roots in your community, people are on the lookout for things that have needs, businesses that want to partner, nonprofits that maybe have something people are in need. When you start to know those things, it helps. We look for needs in the local schools and get to know their administrators. So that particular event was the first time I'd met the Glenpool superintendent and a couple other of their administrators that were excited to see a church van pull up with, you know, school supplies. And so I got to meet them and say hello and hand them my card and say, when you guys need something, let us know. We'd love to be involved, and started asking questions about what was going on in the school. And that was it's been hard to follow up on that, but that was an in that we had. That helps. So we were aware, we put down our roots, we prayed for our community, and then we partnered with local schools, businesses, and people to kind of help get from A to B. Churches can do that in a way that a lot of others can't. Because there's no... What motivates a business to help a school? At best, publicity. That's about it. There's not an incentive to give things away most of the time. Maybe there's a tax write-off, or maybe it clears out some room in the warehouse. So is anybody going to spend a lot of time getting that done? I mean, they might be willing. They're not opposed to it. But are they going to really follow that up and see that it happens? If it's easy, they'll do it. For churches, we have another motivation. We're not actually interested in making any money. And so we're willing to follow some things up and track down some leads that somebody else would say, oh, that's too much effort. It really doesn't help us any in the first place. We're done. The church can say, hey, oh, we'll come by with a van. We'll pick it up. Oh, well, if you'll pick it up, we'll load it out the back door. We can do that much, right? And they were willing to start with having somebody that wanted to. Okay. Churches can do that in ways that maybe nobody else can. We're going to survey the community. Now, this one here, Archer and I kind of part company a little bit just for practical reasons. Archer has 3 or 4 pages on how you need to do door-to-door surveys, not door-to-door Bible studies or door-to-door literature or invitations. He's real big on you need to know who lives in your town. And so the way you do that is you knock doors and you say, I'd like to take a survey, and you gather information, age, people in the home, how many kids, religious affiliation, and things like that. And that's all interesting information. I've done one of those back before I came to Glenpool. I was in a rural, just on the outside edge of Oklahoma City, Midwest City area, and we did one out there. and found out people have dogs, and that was not a lot of fun. It turns out a lot of that information is available. In an information age, a lot of that data just is already assembled somewhere. You just kind of have to look. So a couple of years ago, 2014, I had to do a project for my classes at Oklahoma Christian while I was working on my master's. And one was to do a report on your community and what ministry opportunities. And they wanted statistical data and demographic data and things like that. I just went to the Chamber of Commerce webpage and the City of Glenpool webpage, and they had most of it there. And so it was pretty easy to get that. I didn't have to go knock any doors. My data is all 3 years old now. I noticed when I was preparing for this lesson, I need to go look again and see what's changed. But that information is available. Why would you care about that? Because you don't want to offer a program or even, when I said program, that includes classes and so forth, that are aimed at somebody that doesn't live in your community. Okay? So if you live in a community where there are zero Spanish-speaking people, spending a lot of money on a bilingual Bible class would kind of be a waste. It's a good thing to do, just not in that town. If you live in a community where you have a lot of people speaking Spanish, offering a Bible class in Spanish makes a lot of sense. It doesn't make any sense to have a young families class in a town where all the young families have moved down the road where there's jobs. But if you're in a town where people have stayed or moved in who are young families because there are jobs and places to live, then a young families class actually makes a lot of sense. See what we're saying there? So you try to be aware of who you're working with in your community, and you don't just do something because, well, I heard that worked somewhere. All church ministry is contextual. There is no one-size-fits-all plan for how to process out evangelism. You look and say, what will work in Glenpool? Same message, same goals, but what will work right here is going to be different based on who's there. Education level. Economic level. All those things affect the kind of things that you have. How many little kids do you got running around? Okay. Well, I'll give you an example. The church I was at before this, we didn't have a lot of little kids. And the people that were coming there were older folks. It would have been kind of silly for us to build a playground. Not because it's evil, but because we didn't have anybody to put on it. We weren't going out there. Okay. It doesn't make any sense. Here, you know, something that I don't like that before. Here, you got kids you're practically tripping over on a Sunday morning. You think, it'd be nice if they could go somewhere. It's almost a safety issue to get them towards a playground. So you make decisions like that. What would make sense one place? I would never say, let's build a playground to attract kids. That'd be a silly idea in my mind. But if you have kids popping out of the seams almost, out of it, hiding under the cushions, right? It's nice to have some place where you could send them to be safe. Anyway, in any event, surveying the community, being aware of the data is important. I don't think you have to knock doors, though. And then number four, meet people. This seems like the one that I was wanting more information on this one. Okay, how do I do that, right? But he says, you're just going to have to go out and meet some people. You're going to have to sit down at a softball game and look to the person to your left that you don't know and say, hi. I mean, there's no shortcut, right? I mean, I can give you the data and we can say all the prayers and we can be involved in the school, but eventually you got to turn over and say hi. That is not fun for me. I'll repeat things I've told you before. I'm an introvert. The idea of talking to new people terrifies me. So my solution for that, knowing I wanted to be a minister, was I got into sales. And I was a salesman at 100% commission. I was that guy at the front door of the furniture store. And my job was to meet that person, make a friend, and tell them they need some of my furniture. And I did it because I felt like I needed to learn a skill to get over that fear I had of meeting new people. And I'm never going to like it. Okay, I mean, that's who I am. I'm never going to be the person who just enjoys meeting new people because this is not the way my brain is wired. But I got where I can be passable at it. I mean, I sold some furniture. That was pretty good, actually. Got a few Salesman of the Month pins in there if you want to check one out. Anyway, you get to know people by talking to them. And you ask them questions. What's it like to be a soccer mom, softball mom, whatever, in Glenpool? What's it like to be a new resident? You move in, your family's from out of state. What do you have? What do you not have? Single parent. I was thinking specifically of Glenpool, things we might run into here. Small business owner. And things like that you just ask. So what are you up to? What are you doing? And you get to know some people. Here's the data I got from 3 years ago, just by way of sharing it. As I said, Glenpool has changed so rapidly, even 3 years puts us dramatically out of date, so I need to go see what's out there now, but I just pulled up the research I did before. Unlike many communities, Glenpool is retaining young adults and attracting young families, as indicated by 20% of the city's population in the 21 to 34 age group. Another 28% of the population is in the 35 to 54 age group. All adults 45 and up comprise about a third of the total population. Compared to like where my dad used to preach in Wetumpka, where like 96% of the population was in that 45 and up range, right? I mean, it's just staggering. More than 75% of the households are family households. This was surprising. Nearly 60% of those being married households where both spouses are present. Might surprise you how... Yeah. Now, does that sound low or high to you? What do you say? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's what I thought. I thought it was high. That in a lot of towns, especially bigger cities, that number drops dramatically. In Glenpool, we have a lot of people where you have both parents in the home. That's something to build on, right? That's something to know and think about. So we do offer things for young families and talk about marriage. We talk about raising kids and things like this in classes because that's who lives here. 48% of the population has pursued some type of college education. 25% holds a college degree. That's higher than the state average. So it's a fairly well-educated community. The average household income in Glenpool trade area, so that includes like everything southwest of the river, down to Mounds and then around, and kind of includes most of Sepulpa, is the Glenpool trade area. If you plan a business in Glenpool, that's where your customers are going to come from. Average household income in the Glenpool trade area is about $61,000, and that's within the city itself, it goes up to $68,000 household income, which is higher than the state average also. So you have young families who have jobs, housing that's not outrageously overpriced, and their families are together. I mean, that's the picture of who lives in Glenpool in a lot of these houses. Not all of them, obviously. As Lenora liked to tell us last week, statistics lie. But a lot of that's what we see here. I'm going to run out of time pretty fast. Another thing we have to look for is who's not in that. So what we don't want to do with the data, let me just give you this caution while you're turning to Acts chapter 11. You don't want to say, aha, 40-something percent is this. So let's go after that and ignore everybody else in town. That's a good business model. It's not a good church model. We actually want to know who else needs us. Who else out there needs the gospel? So in Acts chapter 11, somebody read for me verse 19 to start with. Jerry, thank you. So they went a long way, but when they got to those towns, they still only preached to one group of people. They preached to people that are like them. Now, that's a natural human tendency. Let me just tell you that. Going back to when I was in sales, I could tell when a customer came in the door at the end of my time in sales who was going to make that sale and who wasn't. No matter who they met at the door, if they were the cool kids, we had a guy named... what was his first name? Kyle Trusty. I kid you not. He's a salesman named Trusty. I mean, you couldn't buy that. Anyway, he was, you know, your prototypical high school quarterback cool kid. And when the cool kids came in, they just clicked. They found each other. In a room for 500 people, they found each other. And they'd talk about, you know, oh, where'd you go to school? And yeah, whatever, okay? Quiet, nerdy folks came in. I left the line. I said, I'll see you on a bit. And I'll go over and I'll talk to them. The quiet guy over at the mattresses who's pulling up the layers of the foam and wants to know the thread count. Actually, sir, I could tell you if you'd like to know. So those people, I sold all of them because those are my people, right? I know them. We had an old crotchety guy named Ron. And you'd think, how can that guy be a salesman? He's just downright unlikable. But he knew who his people were. He found people that had similar experiences to him, and they'd click and sell them every time. So it's a natural human tendency. You look for people who are like you. It's just something we do. Churches have to work a little harder to get past that because we're not salesmen. We are trying to reach people who are sometimes not like us. So these churches, they go out, hey, we're Jewish folks, so we're going to find other Jewish folk. But what do they do in verses 20 and 21? Who wants to read that for us? Denny, thank you.
And some of the men were men of Cyprus and Cyrene, which when they came unto Antioch, expected to do this, to preach, preaching the Lord Jesus. And the hand of the Lord was with them, and a great number believed and turned to the Lord.
So there are a couple of guys, and they are from Cyprus and Cyrene. These are from Greek areas. They've grown up around Greek. They may be Jewish, but they grew up around Greek folks. So when they go to these towns, they say, well, let's go talk to the Greek folks. And the Lord blesses that effort, reaching a little bit out of their comfort zone. What happens next? What happens for the first time in Acts chapter 11? It is the first time that these people are called Christians. It's the next verse. They aren't called by the name Christian until they start getting out of their comfort zone. Stop only, as long as they're just going to the synagogue, they just look like they're a Jewish group. But when they start talking to and converting Greek converts, that's when it becomes apparent this isn't just a branch of Judaism. These people are doing something different. And this name comes down, I believe, from God to help describe that. These are Christians. So in our community, what are some of the groups that might be a little harder for us to reach or might not be natural? As of 2010, so there's a seven-year-old statistic, 13% of the U.S. population was born in another country. The one that comes to mind would be Mexico, but there are quite a lot of others that are in that mix. Oklahoma, due to its geographical location, houses a large number of Spanish-speaking immigrants, not all of them from Mexico, but a lot of Spanish-speaking immigrants, not all of them here legally. But there are quite a lot of them, okay? And the problem with that is they are notoriously difficult to put into statistics. Especially if they're here illegally, they don't really want to answer the phone and tell you where their address is, right? That's kind of the point. So they are notoriously difficult to catalog and say, so I look at the statistics and it says we don't have very many Spanish-speaking people in Glenpool. And I'm like, yeah, I bet you we do. So there are groups like that that sometimes kind of go under the radar, right? The Asian population in Glenpool is higher than the black household population in Glenpool. I was looking at the statistics on that. So numbers like that. You know, there's a group, and we tend to stick to our own, right? And so folks that kind of look like us tend to overlook folks that kind of look like them. And they tend not to wander into churches that look like this. It takes a little more effort, doesn't it, to reach out and say, okay, what could we do for that community? Native Americans are not immigrants, as they will certainly remind you if you tell them that. I don't have time for my Native American stories, but I have an uncle who is, not full blood. People always laugh when I tell them that because you look at me and I look like kind of a Norwegian Indian. I'm not really what you think of, but his stats was high. But he had no interest in being associated with Dad's part of the family, because those are the white folks' part of the family. And there was some distinction there between them, even in the few interactions we had. And I say that to say this, they live here and constitute also a community within themselves, whether it's tribal tags or tribal activities. They tend to interact together. And so, I'm trying to say that cautiously and not rudely. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying there's a tendency. You have Indian Baptist Church or Indian this church, right? And they tend to kind of group together. So those are some groups within our community that might be easy for us to kind of overlook and say, you know, we're looking at this other group, young families, age this to that, who make this income and have this kind of education, that's who we're looking for. But the other folks live here too, quite a lot of them actually, and are looking for Christ Jesus, and we need to be careful about overlooking any of our subgroups that live in this community. How about a map, just in our last 60 seconds? I plotted you Every member I could find in our database that had an address I could plot, I stuck on a map. Yes, you can have one later. See, Larry's thinking, what could I do with that map? Some of the deacons I think will be interested. But anyway, I put them on a map. Well, where do we live? Well, as predicted, we kind of concentrated around Glenpool. That makes sense. But there's quite a broad area, actually. Most of it southwest of the river, right? Which corresponds, let me show you the next chart because I'm running out of time. These are visitors in the last year or two. Members might be willing to drive up from Okmulgee. Visitors typically don't. Members are closer, but also, notice again, southwest of the river. Nobody crosses the river to go to church. So then you notice some things like that, and you ask yourself, okay, so those are the people who are wandering in and at least filling out a card. Okay, we don't know who all wanders in and doesn't fill out a card. Well, that starts to kind of give you an idea of where people are that are interested and helps to kind of shape our understanding of the community we're trying to reach. I'm completely out of time. Sorry about that. If you want some more data, I'd be happy to give you the full report that I made up 3 years ago, and it'd be 3 years out of date, but you're welcome to look at it.